This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from the City University of New York. Today, American upper middle class parenting. Our panelists are Leslie Hinkson from Georgetown University, Gabriel Rossman from UCLA, and Christina Sharp from the University of Washington. Our discussion was recorded on May 7th, 2019. So sociology really got a great showing and a pretty good piece in the New York Times Upshot, The Relentlessness of Modern Parenting. Did you guys read that?
Nope.
I was too busy with upper middle class parenting.
No, well, that's what it's about. First of all, I'll say off the top, it's a piece that showcased some great sociologists of the family. Friend of the show, Philip Cohen, was mentioned, Jessica Calarco, Caitlin Collins, Liana Sayer. And basically what it's talking about is the development of this really intense parenting style, like heavy on time commitment, heavy on involvement, and some crazy facts emerge. Like, for example, parents spend on average about 5 hours a week reading to kids, doing crafts with them, attending recitals and games. And this is up from about an hour and 45 minutes in 1975. Mothers who work spend just about as much time tending to their children as stay-at-home moms did in the 1970s. And of course, fathers are also investing far more time than they did historically as well. So there's a style of parenting. It's very resource heavy. It costs a lot in time. It costs a lot in emotional energy. It costs a lot in money. And that's what parents are doing. And it's starting to trickle down.
Wow, it's almost as if you'd expect this to have some impact on fertility.
Well, does it? Or I wonder.
Or is it the other way around?
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Go on, Gabe.
Well, yeah, right. I mean, so this is what biologists would call R versus K selection of, you know, basically, do you have a ton of acorns or do you have one whale calf? Mm-hmm. And, you know, your acorn, your oak tree that makes, you know, 10,000 acorns or your sea urchin that shoots out, you know, 10,000 polyps, you know, they make almost no investment in each offspring. And they just figure, well, one out of 10,000 will survive and the rest will, you know, get lured into a van or, you know, fall off their bicycle or whatever. Mm-hmm. But big deal, there's 9,999 where that came from. Whereas like, you know, a whale will birth one calf every 3 years and then, you know, the whale calf will follow it around and till its little sibling is born and drink milk and, you know, all that sort of thing. And we basically have, you know, upper middle class parenting is the reductio ad absurdum, where we have so much investment in parenting that we actually drive it below replacement fertility.
Do you think it's that though? Or do you, like, I mean, I would understand if the time patterns were that people were rising on a per child basis, but the total time that parents were devoting to parenting wasn't going up. But now it seems like the total time that people are investing in kids is higher.
Well,
no, that makes perfect sense.
It totally does. Like, given what Gabriel was saying, right? I mean, like, if we're focusing primarily on the upper middle class, right? Mm-hmm. If we look at their rates of fertility, right? Their fertility rates have been dropping, right? Mm-hmm. They are delaying marriage. They are delaying, like, on average, they are delaying, like, when they have their first child. And that reduces the number of children that they have. And so if you're going to have just one, maybe two precious offspring, mm-hmm. right? And we're also supposedly in the middle of this uber competitive, you know, college entrance race, you know, mm-hmm. as my kids tell me all the time, oh my God, mom, it was so much easier when you were little, right? It makes sense that they would be engaging in, you know, this concerted cultivation as Annette Leroux coined. So
it's interesting, like, on some level, maybe I get it, or maybe the idea is if you have seven kids, then like the forces of nature will make one of them able to support the rest or something like that. Like there could be a rational allocation of time, but I have to believe that there's some non-rationality going on there, or like changing perceptions of like how much your parenting is worth in terms of fulfillment. Like it seems like, people are just like, your identity as a parent has become more salient. I get my sense is people don't neglect kids as much as they might have in the past, and that there's a qualitative change. It's not just about a strategy of maximizing, I don't know, the family's well-being or your, you know, your progeny's overall level.
Well, I mean,
survival.
It could be both, right? I mean, I think there's also a certain aspect, particularly thinking about the upper middle class, of, you know, sort of keeping up with the Joneses or respectability politics, whatever it is you want to call it, where, you know, your neighbor is like, yeah, you know, my child is, you know, enrolled in A, B, C, and D, right? And then they look at you and say, what is your child enrolled in? And you're just like, nothing. We just hang out in the front yard. I mean, I think that there is an element of, you know, of this kind of adult peer pressure in these kinds of communities to actually at least be able to display to everyone else that you're just as invested in your child, as they are.
Christina, when you talk to the parents of previous generations, do you get a sense that younger parents are conceiving of parenthood in fundamentally different terms from, you know, previous generations? Or is it that you're focusing on sort of relationships with problems, so it's not a good marker? Like, what's your sense based on what you've observed?
So I would say, different from my estrangement work, I've looked at issues like postpartum depression and women who give up their child for adoption, and the ideology around intensive parenting is really crushing. And I think it's becoming more so that not just the intensity of which parents have to parent their children, but like the unintended consequences for people who might not be performing parenthood in that way.
Interesting.
Is really problematic, and we know that like suicide among women is such a high rate for maternal death, and I wouldn't be surprised if some of that has to do with the pressures of being a mother, the pressures of parenthood, and the expectations, the increasing expectations that we see.
It's interesting, there are some pushbacks on this though, right? Like, I've heard of free range parenting. The article mentions it. I have a neighbor who's like a free range parent, and frankly, she's like a role model for me. And then there's like it's a distinctly American way of parenting, isn't it? Like, it's my understanding. I remember hearing about there was a book on French parenting years ago. I forget what it was that sort of made the rounds, and there's other research that shows that other cultures, they don't have this intense bonding with their kids, or sort of they're more parents, like there's more distance between them. What do you guys feel about this? Is it nuts? Does it make sense? Like,
well, I mean, I was raised in Brooklyn during the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, and like my grandmother would still say, okay, go outside. Right. Because there's this idea that, you know what, there are things that you need to do, right, in terms of your socialization. There are things I need to do in this household that I can't get done, right, you know, with you in here. Go ahead and learn the way of the streets, like hopefully not learning how to use crack cocaine, but, you know, but learn how to exist and survive. And I kind of feel like, you know, today in Brooklyn, where we don't have like even a fraction of the level of violence and crime that we had when I was growing up, like there are parents who live in perfectly safe communities who would not feel fine just telling their kids to go outside and play, and who wouldn't be fine with just letting their kids figure out what to do with their free time.
How do you parent then? Do you have more of a free range attitude, or?
I am, yes, I do. I have more of a free range attitude than my kids do, right? You know, right? They're just like, oh my God, mom, you don't care about me. Right? Why haven't we been talking about college since eighth grade, right? I mean, this is a sort of thing that is infectious. I mean, I think it's a kind of, it's an approach to parenting that I think sort of pulls parents into that kind of world, regardless of whether or not they would have thought that it was a good idea to schedule their child for every moment of the day, yeah, because that's what's done in your community. But children see it too, right? Mm-hmm. And they sometimes will take it as an indication of they interpret it as, well, are you really invested in me, mom? Are you really invested in me, dad? So I don't know. I think it's this self-reinforcing thing that, you know, that I think affects parents and kids.
It's interesting. Like, there'd be a desire not to disappoint your kids in a way. Like, these parents might be doing this in part just so that their kids feel like they did everything possible.
Yeah.
Well, there's also things of, you know, schools are increasingly greedy institutions where, mm-hmm, you know, there's an expectation that every other afternoon you're going to be there to watch some puppet show and, you know, and answer 85 emails a day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then aside from that, there's the notion that, there, a lot of this is kind of peer pressure, particularly among women. Right. Where, you know, there's a notion of like, oh, you haven't breastfed, you know, don't you know that it could raise IQs by 2 IQ points, you know, or whatever. And then, you know, you find out later that research doesn't replicate. And The Economist, Emily Oster, who I believe is at Brown now, you know, just published her second book. Brown. Yeah. Cool. You know, basically saying that if you go through all these studies, you find out that, first of all, a lot of them are based on thoroughly mediocre science, you know, samples of 25, that sort of thing. And second of all, that even in the best case, the effect sizes are relatively small. And so if you put any value on the hassle, inconvenience, discomfort, whatever, for the parents, you know, it doesn't really make sense to have this, right? And this mentality of like, well, even if it's a small effect, don't you want to do everything possible for your kid? It's like, well, not if it ruins your life and makes you not want to have more kids.
And then there's also like the inequality aspect of this is just mind-boggling. I remember having this discussion with a friend. Like, I am literally pouring, not just am I pouring, literally thousands of dollars into giving my kids various forms of supplemental schooling and training and edification experiences. But like, yeah, they're getting like, it's a lot of one-on-one time. Like, there's, it's a huge, huge investment. And I wonder, like, one, is this going to make any difference in the grand scheme of things? And if it does make a difference, well, how's a kid from a family of modest means going to compete with like these upper middle class kids who already benefit from like a segregated school system to start with? And then I add on top of that just tons and tons of extra training.
Now, how much do you think that this actually improves upper middle class kids in some type of human capital sense versus like a cultural capital habitus sense, right? I mean, to what extent does this actually make, you know, our kids better at things that we can meaningfully call skills? And to what extent does it just kind of like give them somewhat arbitrary class markers? And I know that that's somewhat of a fuzzy boundary, right? And that one person's skill is another. So for instance, if your kid becomes a lacrosse team captain, is that meaningfully considered cultural capital, or is that meaningfully considered a skill?
Right.
I think that's a somewhat arbitrary distinction. But, you know, I mean, we could kind of distinguish between, you know, are they, you know, really good at, say, math, which I think is undoubtedly a skill, versus just, you know, do they know to say, like, oh, I heard that on All Things Considered, which I think is, you know, definitely cultural capital. So, I mean, I feel like a lot of this will come down to cultural capital stuff, but it's possible some of it would be, you know, more human capital.
I was going to say, I wonder too how much that interplays with like the experience of bullying. So I feel like bullying looks different today, where sometimes the bullying happens around more of this cultural capital. Mm-hmm. Oh, you didn't have the same opportunities. You don't wear the same brand clothes I have, and how that impacts actual learning and the experience at school.
Yeah, no, I think that that's a totally valid point. I mean, again, not to keep going back to like ancient history when I was a kid, but you know, even back in the day in the hood, right? I mean, if you didn't wear the right the right sneakers, right? Or if you didn't have the right gear, I mean, you would be bullied for that. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like that's something that I'm seeing now that I've moved on up and I'm in this upper middle class milieu raising children. There's bullying, not just among the kids, mm-hmm. In terms of what they have and don't have, but also amongst parents, particularly between mothers. Well, mm-hmm. I wanted to jump in and respond to Gabe's Please. Question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Gabriel was like, is this human capital? Is this cultural capital? And one of the things I'm not entirely certain which of these it is more. I mean, there's definitely a lot of cultural capital being transmitted here, right? Mm-hmm. And that's not something to be discounted. But one of the things I also wanted to bring up is, at least in the high schools in both public and private in Montgomery County, Maryland, where I live in Bethesda, we have seen this significant uptick in attempted suicide and also successful suicide rates among teenagers. Number one, number two, we've seen an uptick in our young people who are experiencing different types of mental health distress. Mm-hmm. And I think that actually is tied to a lot of this intensive parenting. And I wish that we could find, it's interesting because we always have these forums where the parents are coming together and asking the schools, what can you do to help reduce the stress on our kids? Mm-hmm. And we never, when we get together in these forums, ask the schools, what can we do as parents to stop putting this pressure on our kids? So,
won't somebody raise my child right?
So that's a good point. So if you... I can't remember if it was on the show or just an article I wrote for National Review, but about a year ago, I was bitching about this thing called the Mastery Transcript Consortium, which would basically replace mm-hmm. Grades for prep schools with something that sounds kind of like a personality profile or horoscope. And, mm-hmm. I saw it as inegalitarian in that it was an attempt to basically say, well, all the kids at, St. Snobby's Prep, are top of the class, but if you listen to the people who are behind it, they say that the goal is to reduce stress, and the kind of like super competitive nature of grades at top prep schools, and then likewise another thing that's kind of like that is Jimenez at Stanford had an article in ASR a few years ago called "When White's Just All Right." That was talking about white flight from Silicon Valley public schools. Although it's not the typical kind of white flight that you imagine, right? Typically, when we think of white flight, we think of either there's a neighborhood transition or there's busing or something like that. And white parents take their kids out of public schools because of the perception that kids of other ethnicities are going to introduce, say, discipline problems. But mm-hmm. in these Silicon Valley schools mm-hmm. that Jimenez was looking at, they were actually, the white parents were pulling their kids out of the Silicon Valley public schools because there was an influx of Asians who had an even more stressful parenting style than mm-hmm. Upper middle class whites did. And they basically saw it as, this influx of like, super type A, like even more type A than white upper middle class parents, type A Asian upper middle class parents were making the school super competitive and super stressful. And, my kid's going to end up developing an eating disorder or, suicide attempts or whatever if I don't transfer them to, St. the Dude Academy, where they can kind of have a more laid back education.
I would bet a lot of this is cultural capital transmission, like this, that, or just, cultural capital transmission in the sense of being part of the college admissions game. Cause that's part of it with all these esoteric sports. But you got to think there is some, like when a highly educated person spends time with their child, you got to think that the child's going to pick up vocabulary, the child's going to pick up, you know, ideas, basic concepts, theories, reasoning styles, and things like that. I have to think that the one-on-one time with an engaged parent, if the parent has high human capital, that there's some transmission going on. I have no basis for knowing that for sure, but that's my sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least in theory, yes, right? But I mean, I don't know how much we know qualitatively about what is actually being transmitted, right, and performed during that time together. You know, is it just sit up straight? You know, don't use the word it's not a word, right? Blah blah blah. Or is there also this sort of level of let's just hang out, right? And let's have fun. And in doing so, learn, right? I mean, I think that those are very, very different ways of spending time together and very different ways of transmitting both cultural and human capital. And I think with the latter being preferable, the latter being the one where, you know, I think children are much more likely to retain it and actually think of it as something of value, as opposed to the former where it's like, these are just rules, right? That I can't wait to break.
Clearly we need to bring in an expert. So if anybody has any ideas for the fall, let us know. You've been listening to The Annex, an academic sociology podcast. You can visit our show site at sociocast.org/annex. We are on Twitter at @SociAnnex and on Facebook, The Annex Sociology Podcast. Our producer is Liseth Moreno. Music by Lena Orsa. I'm Joseph Cohen. Thank you for listening.